You're listening to the Derms and Conditions Podcast.
Well, I'm Dr. Jim DelRosso, based in Las Vegas, Nevada, clinical research here and clinical practice, educational initiatives, but we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk today with Dr. Jason Hawks, who's been on before. If you go back and listen to a prior Derms and Conditions podcast, he's here today on another podcast on what I think is a very important topic and one that's getting a lot of play in the literature now. We're familiar with CIU, chronic idiopathic urticaria. We're now talking about chronic spontaneous urticaria, and he might have some clinical relevance as to why that title was changed. But it's great to have Jason Hawks here, who is a medical dermatologist in the trenches seeing patients in Rockland, California, and has a lot of background in both basic science and clinical dermatology. So, Jason, welcome this morning. It's great to have you here. Good to hear your voice.
Thanks, Jim. It's exciting to be back, and I always enjoy having conversations with you.
Yep. Well, you're probably one of the few people, so it's nice to hear that. But anyway, with chronic spontaneous urticaria, and I've even seen some literature where they say autoimmune chronic spontaneous urticaria, and I get somewhat, I don't want to say nervous, but I question when we start to have these new initiatives that they're based on maybe some specific therapies, but they don't necessarily cover the breadth of the topic. So can you give me your, when you hear chronic spontaneous urticaria, or you're looking at information that's being published on it or studies, what's the breadth of what that means right now?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question, and it's something that isn't done well in textbooks or literature. And that's really explaining the fact that urticaria is a collection of conditions. And so when we're talking about urticaria, we're not talking about one thing, we're talking about multiple things. So the way I think about it in terms of what you're asking is, I think of acute and chronic urticaria. That's the first division in that bucket. So acute disease are symptoms less than 6 weeks. Chronic disease, symptoms greater than 6 weeks. But then within the chronic bucket, there are two major divisions. So we have 20% of the chronic cases are what we call the physical urticarias or the chronic inducible urticarias. Those are things that like cold urticaria, aquagenic, solar urticaria. And by definition, they have a clear cause. So 20% of these chronic cases, we can attribute it to something. I experienced that personally in medical school when I developed cold urticaria. When I would go out and get cold, I would get hives, I'd rewarm, they'd eventually go away. So that's a very clear cause. I never got hives from another environmental factor or trigger. Now, in contrast, we have the other 80% of chronic cases, which were, as you mentioned, considered chronic idiopathic urticaria, meaning that we didn't really know a cause, differentiating them from the inducible or physical, where there's a clear cause. And then we went to spontaneous urticaria. I think that change to spontaneous urticaria, I looked this up one time. If you look up the definition of spontaneous, basically the definition is that it's occurring without a stimuli or a cause. And so I believe that the terminology is really to differentiate it from the other type of chronic urticaria, which has a clear trigger, such as the physical inducible cases.
So in the room with a patient that comes in that tells you, you know, they have hives, you're getting to see some of them, quote, welts or whatever. Sometimes they can't even describe that. But you're looking at the patient and you know their urticarial lesions, and they've had a history of these coming and going, but they have them a lot of the time and it's been going on for months to years. And are there situations where the conventional, visual appearance of chronic spontaneous urticaria can actually be a physical urticaria, but they've never figured out that they can relate it to something? In other words, going out in the cold and they don't necessarily equate it with temperature, they could come in looking like a chronic spontaneous urticaria that we don't know what the source might be. Can you be fooled by that?
Yeah, no, it's an important point, which is that, patients don't can't always identify, you know, a factor that might be setting off their hives. I like to approach it a different way with patients. I like to say that, you know, let's just take, for example, cold, since you brought it up. We can talk about situations and say, yeah, well, I was out and I think I was cold and I got hives. But then you can think about those situations where, you know, it's in the summer, for example, and it's not cold outside and they're still getting hives. So the one thing about the physical urticaria is that they have that consistency with exposure. And a lot of those patients, while they haven't maybe thought about cold, they'll say, actually, you know, it's really interesting that, you know, I was doing such and such and it was freezing outside and I was out for 3 hours and I never got hives. Right. And so I think it's helpful that while we think about it as black and white, you know, it's definitive. I think there's probably situations where you have patients who have CSU, for example, that something might sort of set off the cascade and set up disease. I don't think of it so much as black and white as much as is there an obvious predominant trigger, or is it something that the patient overall, when we go through some of the common inducible or physical cases, they can't really tie it to any pattern. And I don't make a fuss beyond that. Why? Because treatments ultimately work pretty similar for a lot of cases. That's not always true with the in physical inducible urticaria cases, but for the most part, we can get a lot of patients better in that same category, even if we don't have the exact trigger.
So how often now when you're seeing a patient, I mean, I'm going back and I've been, you know, I did my residency in the mid-80s. So what did we have? We had, you know, sedating antihistamines, which we seem to give to everybody. And we now know that a lot of these are not, quote, histaminergic. That's why these patients didn't get a lot better, except maybe they were put to sleep. Or we would give patients short bursts of oral prednisone or injectable triamcinolone. And then we try all these other things, trying to select maybe cyproheptadine, maybe a little different antihistamine, but we really weren't differentiating everything. But we have a lot of mechanisms now. When you're seeing this patient, one of the things that we were often taught to do is ask them about certain medications, because a lot of times opioids, things like codeine or others, analgesics, would trigger direct release from mast cells. That's what we were always taught. Are there certain situations where you have certain medications that you go through up front because you want to exclude common drug-induced causes of urticaria that nobody's thought about?
Yeah, it's definitely important to run through that differential diagnosis with patients. And obviously, urticarial type drug reactions are in that differential diagnosis for urticaria. And you'll also have other urticarial-like conditions, say, you know, mastocytosis that we see in children or urticarial BP. One of the key differentiating factors, though, is that many of those lesions that look urticarial, they don't actually last less than 24 hours. So, for example, an urticarial type drug reaction, sometimes we'll see those lesions persist. And that's one of the clues that can really help in the diagnosis of CSU, because a biopsy doesn't often distinguish between some of those like drug reaction and CSU. They can have some of the same nonspecific, you know, histologic findings. So one is that we want to look at the timing, because I feel like a lot of patients are inclined to think there must be some cause so they can go back. There's that recall bias. But the chronology of when symptoms truly started can be very helpful. So if they've ever had episodes before they went on drug X, for example, that's very helpful, because then we can eliminate drug X as a cause. But also, I think just going back through, you know, the history and really explaining to patients that, you know, with true urticaria, a single lesion, it's an individual lesion, should last hours, not longer than 24 hours. That often excludes the vast majority of other conditions in the differential diagnosis. And I think that's extremely helpful.
Yeah, you mentioned urticarial BP, urticarial bullous pemphigoid, which I've seen some cases, and that very pruritic. And usually they're older people, you know, they're in, mm-hmm. in the quote elderly category, the people that I would fall under now. And even older than myself, you know. So, you know, those lesions, they don't come and go in less than 24 hours. And they're mm-hmm. very urticarial looking. They tend to be diffuse, but you're not seeing any blisters or having them tell you that they had any blistered areas. that can happen sometimes for months before the bullous pemphigoid, what we think of the bullous lesions of bullous pemphigoid emerge, but they are not lesions that come and go. So I think that's a really important distinguishing feature. So let's get into therapies because, you know, we've had some of the older agents and I see things written in the literature. Never give the patient systemic corticosteroids anymore for CSU ever, you know, and I never like to be that dogmatic. But let's start with something that we often commonly have done to get patients more comfortable while we're trying to figure things out, and that's to give them a couple of weeks of prednisone or, you know, injectable triamcinolone. Is that truly an absolute no-no?
I'm like you. I think there are very few like absolute no-nos in the clinical practice. That's why it's the art of medicine that, you know, I can think of a patient that just very recently, you know, she had terrible urticaria that we were trying a number of things, couldn't really get under control. And yet, you know, it was really interfering with her job that, you know, we needed to use a short course of oral prednisone just to get the disease under control that she could get back to her daily life. I don't like to do it. And I don't like to do it primarily because we know the downsides of oral prednisone, especially in, as you mentioned, some of our older patients where they have higher risk factors. And it's a short-term medication and we're dealing with a chronic problem. But it's the way I also use cyclosporin, for example. Like when I need to get something under control before I get to that stable long-term treatment, I think of it that way in urticaria. So I don't think it's an absolute no-no, but it's not ideal because we know that, you know, for example, the studies show for CSU at 10 years, more than half of patients still have disease. They haven't gone into remission. So we know that in the majority of patients, we're dealing with a chronic condition. So prednisone automatically becomes an inefficient therapy and an inappropriate therapy for that reason. But I do pull it at times when nothing else is working.
But you have a high threshold for using it. The problem with it is patients come in, they feel so much better. They don't necessarily understand the difference. They just know they're miserable and they want more. If you have a low threshold, you find yourself reflexly doing it more. That's not good.
Definitely. Yeah, your point is, you know, we should be trying other therapies. Now, there's one advantage to the antihistamines, which is that they work pretty quickly. Now, one of the things that I don't like about both the Quad AI and the international guidelines is they leave this really big range of updosing the antihistamines that you can do it over 1 to 4 weeks. Well, 4 weeks can seem like a lifetime for these patients that are really miserable. So one of the things that I do in practice is that when I updose antihistamines, I'll start with the regular one pill a day. Just say, for example, cetirizine, 10 milligrams, start with that once a day. But every 2 to 3 days, I'm going to add a pill until I get to the four. So it doesn't need to take 4 weeks. Within a week, week and a half, you can get patients up to that high dose. And so I like to start with things, escalate quickly. And when a class of medication isn't working, it's time to move on. Right, there's no point in trying to beat the same mechanism of action. Once we get to that high dose, if it's not working, it's time to move on, find a new therapy, because as you mentioned, there may be a different immune mechanism driving their clinical disease.
So before we get to some of the, there's a variety of different new mechanisms of action. There are these Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitors that are in development. There's another IgG1 anti-IgE antibody beyond just omalizumab, but let's start with omalizumab, right? With Xolair. When we could mention the brand name with the when it's available, just for familiarity, like cetirizine was Zyrtec, but we have others, right? We have several fexofenadine, right. Allegra, whatever, just for familiarity. But you know, let's just look at omalizumab, because I remember when that came, it was being brought to dermatologists and to allergists, but it had this anaphylaxis cloud over its head, which I think there's still a lot of controversy about how important or how realistic that was as far as being a common clinical concern. But you had to have the patient stay around for a couple of hours and bring home an EpiPen. And it wasn't, you had to swirl it for 25 minutes. And it was difficult to do in a dermatology practice. So I felt like omalizumab fell away from dermatology because of the impracticality in a dermatology office. Where in an allergy office, they have EpiPens just when they're giving hyposensitization shots because they know they can have anaphylaxis, probably more so with that than with omalizumab. Where are we right now with omalizumab? Because it is available, and I found it to be a very effective medication for these patients.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And there's multiple layers to this. I think one, dermatology probably steered away from these patients in general because they were difficult. And we've seen that with other conditions. And I think the anaphylaxis sort of became a scapegoat as to why we would refer these patients out, because I think what you're getting at is we didn't have great therapies. But here's the facts about anaphylaxis. There have been 67 real-life CSU studies. There was a meta-analysis in JAMA Derm. And so we have a lot of mega data on the clinical use of omalizumab. And when you look back at the data from even its approval from its pivotal phase 3 studies, the rate of anaphylaxis was 0.1 to 0.2%. And those anaphylaxis cases didn't occur in CSU patients. They occurred in patients receiving omalizumab for a different indication. So I think the risk of anaphylaxis is extremely low. I've never seen it. I've never met a provider who actually ever witnessed a patient have anaphylaxis that they were treating for urticaria. And so for that reason, it was never a concern for me. I was lucky to have trained next to a great dermatologist who is also an allergist. So as a resident in my resident continuity clinic, he pushed me to use it from the very beginning. And I saw the clear benefits heavily outweigh the risks. So I think it's an excellent medication that probably, well, easily and undoubtedly has the best data of any other therapy for the treatment of urticaria. And for that reason, it has unanimous recommendations in all guidelines, and I believe has been the standard of care for many years.
Of the available ones, we have a lot of new things coming along, which I do want to touch upon. But it does have an easier injectable form, right? You don't necessarily have to be shaking it up or get a swirler with omalizumab anymore. Is that true?
Yeah, this is very similar to the, injectable medications we use, not the auto injections, but the syringes for, say, like psoriasis. Those medications, they are virtually identical. And, you can either give 150, the single injection, or you can give the two doses, the 300. I typically use the higher dose because it tends to work better for patients and the safety profile's the same. But these are simple to administer. And really what we're having, and patients can now self-inject, right? So rather than before where they had to come in and just sit in the office, we make sure they tolerate it. And then after that, they're injecting at home, which makes it easy.
Makes it a lot easier. And you brought up a very interesting point in the beginning. I think because of that anaphylaxis and that unfamiliarity amongst dermatologists, they would start with the 150 thinking they were taking the safer route, but you capture people a lot sooner. And like you said, they're miserable patients. If you're not getting an early capture, they may give up. And this is not a drug you want to give up on. So you have the best chance of getting optimized success by starting with the higher dose.
Right.
Are there times where you increase the frequency? Because I've seen some references on updosing omalizumab that you might go more often than the standard use. I believe once a month is what's recommended as the standard dosing.
Yeah, we typically use once a month or every 4 weeks, and I have heard of individuals using it every 2 weeks. I tend to just push the dose, so I've gone up as high as 600 milligrams monthly. A lot of the allergists, one allergist that has been a mentor of mine, would push patients up to 450, 600, and that monthly dosing still works. I've heard of benefit going both ways. And I think that's true. If you're using any of the systemic biologic medications, we've done this in a lot of different indications where we adjust it, maybe give it a little bit more frequently. And that's the whole approach of that personalized medicine, right? We try to do what we need to do for that patient sitting in front of us. So I don't get too constrained by the, traditional dosing requirements if I feel like there's a need.
Well, and the dosing that's in the package insert, or in what we used to actually get an actual physical physician desk reference, are based on the studies, them coming up with what worked in the majority of patients, because they're not going to have a bunch of different dosages in there. But that doesn't mean there weren't individuals that needed more or less than that.
Correct.
And that's going back to being the art of medicine. So bring me forward now, because I'm trying to keep up with this literature, and there are too many disease states now and so much new information. As you know, it's a challenge for all of us. But what about some of these newer therapies? You know, we have dupilumab. There's been a lot of data on dupilumab for chronic spontaneous urticaria. It's not yet gotten its FDA approval, but where you see that fitting in, or there's another one, I think it's Ligelizumab, am I saying mm-hmm. that right? I don't want to butcher any of these, but there's Bruton tyrosine kinase, and there are some other mechanisms based on different receptors. Can you give me just a summary of where you think this is going and where it will fit in?
Yeah, so we're seeing a shift in the conversation about sort of chronic inflammatory diseases. We talk about a lot of the T-cell mediated diseases like psoriasis and eczema. We talk about the autoimmune conditions like dermatomyositis or lupus, which are the antibody production, the B-cells. Well, now we're talking about a group of conditions that really the mast cell is the central immune player. And so the mast cell has a lot of ways to be activated. The primary mechanism of CSU is definitely involving antibodies with IgE and IgG. Those can activate the mast cell. And that's where omalizumab comes in, is blocking its anti-IgE monoclonal antibody. Now, ligelizumab, which was manufactured and really the studies produced by Novartis, was really just a high affinity anti-IgE antibody. So it's about a 50 times greater affinity. So the idea is that if we could inhibit IgE with a greater affinity, maybe we could push the clinical results. However, in 2022, they discontinued further development of that product because there was really no difference between that treatment and omalizumab. So despite the higher affinity, we weren't achieving sort of greater success, which tells me sort of from the immunology side that you are effectively blocking IgE, but there's some other IgE independent mechanism driving disease, which brings you nicely into the other mechanisms. And we know that antihistamines, even at the high fourfold dosing, only work in about 50% of patients. So now we start saying, well, what are some of these other mechanisms? Well, the obvious one that you first mentioned was dupilumab, because we know that type 2 inflammation and a lot of the type 2 inflammatory cells are involved in the response once mast cells become activated. So when mast cells become activated, they start to trigger the immune response and they start to recruit other immune cells. So lymphocytes, basophils, eosinophils. So I think the idea is that type 2 inflammation is sort of supporting those activated mast cells. So by blocking the type 2 inflammation with dupilumab, by blocking IL-4 and 13, we could shut off sort of these secondary supporting immune cells with the mast cell and kind of break that chronic cycle of itch and hive formation. So that's sort of why blocking type 2 inflammation would make sense. And then when we talk about some of the newer mechanisms, so you mentioned remibrutinib, which is a BTK inhibitor. We also have an SYK inhibitor. These are both intracellular signaling
mechanisms.
These
are kinases. These have to do with kinase mechanisms, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So I think very similar to like the JAK inhibitor space. It's an intracellular signaling mechanism. And these BTK in particular is tied to the high affinity IgE receptor. So that kind of makes sense. If IgE is the main receptor activated on mast cells, then that receptor and its signaling must be important in disease. So by inhibiting BTK with remibrutinib, the thought is we can shut off that signaling from that high affinity IgE receptor that is working to activate the mast cell, which is sort of the first domino that falls in this disease that sets off that chain reaction.
So
that's kind of the concepts for why these work.
So we have a lot to look forward to. We obviously have to look at the efficacy and the safety implications of all these treatments. But what I'm hearing right now, beyond just having a high bar for the occasional situation to, for the short term, help somebody get under a control in the short term, but not repeatedly with oral corticosteroids, which is something we want to try to get away from. But we don't want people to feel like a policeman's going to come in and arrest you if you do that just once, right? But we do have to have a high bar for that use. Dermatologists that maybe gave up on omalizumab, and I'm just saying that one because that's the only one we have to use. If there were other ones, we'd certainly talk about them too. Maybe want to revisit where that fits in now and how it's much easier to use compared to years ago where people may have shied away from it. Would you say that's accurate?
Definitely. These are patients that have very heavy burdens of disease. Their quality of life impact can be the same as having severe coronary artery disease. So by avoiding the one approved therapy that we know is effective in, you know, 3/4 of patients, that's a big disservice to our patient. However, not everybody responds to that therapy, which is why we need these newer mechanisms of action. And I think dermatologists have to come back to saying this is a dermatologic disease. This belongs in our specialty. We can help patients. And now we're going to have multiple options to pull from. And that's good for our specialty. It's good for our patients. So we can't sort of eliminate one really important therapy, even though we're going to have others which are going to play a role for those other unique patients that have disease that's IgE independent.
And each one of those is going to have to find its way on its own merit. Right.
Correct.
I have one more question before I let you go, because I know you, I'm sure you have some patients you need to see. Workup. Okay. When I remember back when I was a resident and really for many years in practice, you know, urticaria, you have to think about, does the patient have an underlying malignancy or something else that you're missing? And that would be a cloud of worry over our heads. But then you'd see all these articles come out saying, we looked at large number of patients, we've never found anything. And then you'd get a case report of someone who happened to have a malignancy, and the worry would start all over again. When patients come in with CSU and you've excluded physical urticarias and, you know, medications, etc., and it's true CSU that you don't have a cause in your mind, is there a basic workup that you do or repeat periodically that you would recommend?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'll just put it out there right up front that it's controversial and there's conflicting data. So if you look at some of the data, particularly those that are heavily driven by the allergists, there's recommendation to, you know, get a CBC at a minimum, a CMP. Sometimes there's ESR, CRP, and then also IgE levels or even thyroid tests. But you're right in that there have been other studies, particularly those from the Europeans, that have shown that even when you sort of went full court press and looked for all these other possible drivers of the CSU, that yielded a very low number of patients. So it argues that it's really not a cost-effective approach. I tend to look at the diagnosis as being still clinical. It does not require lab testing to make a diagnosis. It doesn't require a biopsy to make a diagnosis. I then look at other aspects of the patient's health. Are they feeling well? For example, are they having night sweats or unexplained weight loss? Like, I start using symptoms screening for hypothyroidism, for example. And when there's a suspicion or it's unclear or there might be symptoms that could be associated, I have no problem checking that. But I think a lot of these tests that are often recommended, what we know is that they don't always correlate with disease activity, and they don't even correlate with disease response. And IgE levels is a good example where they're not always elevated in CSU patients, and they don't even go down in patients in some situations where their disease clearly got better on a therapy. So I think the jury's out on whether any testing is necessary. I don't ever perform the same test for all patients. I only perform ancillary testing when I think it's clinically appropriate or indicated from their history.
And repeat it as the history of the patient might change over time, at different points in time. Jason, thank you so much. You always teach me a lot. I'm looking forward to seeing you at an upcoming meeting. I caught you very briefly at the Fall Clinical in Las Vegas, which was just nice to see you. And thanks again. And if I could help you in reverse, where I may be able to potentially teach you something, I'm always here, but I'm not likely going to get that phone call. Thanks so much.
No, always great to be with you, Jim. I always learn from you, and it's always great to see you, and I hope that sooner than later.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Derms and Conditions. If you have any questions, please email us at podcast@dermsquared.com. That's podcast at dermsquared.com. Podcast@dermsquared.com.